Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois. And I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Raymond Biesinger is an illustrator, architecture enthusiast, regional historian, artist, musician, and best-selling author currently based in Montreal, Quebec. Having spent a good informative chunk of his life in Edmonton, Alberta, Biesinger co-founded the hard-touring and prolific band The Famines, which was active between roughly around 2008 and 2019. Biesinger has been a working illustrator and artist himself since around 2005, with a very impressive list of clients and collaborators, and he co-founded the music publishing imprint and quasi-label Pentagon Black. In 2022, Goose Lane Editions published the best-selling book 305 Lost Buildings of Canada, a collaboration between Biesinger and Globe and Mail architecture critic Alex Bezukhovich, which follows work Biesinger has done to chronicle spaces that existed and still do, which often serve marginalized communities throughout the history of Canada. Raymond and I connected recently for a talk about things like the most recent and possibly the first time we ever met, when Cadence Weapon introduced us outside of a Sadie's show in Edmonton, why he didn't actually feel like attending that show, his time in The Famines and why he ostensibly retired from music making, his Edmonton social circles and why he began illustrating in the first place, why his work highlights marginalized lives and his use of historical adaptation, how his collaboration with Alex Bezukhovich on their book came about, people who steal his work, an idea for his next book, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners just like you who follow and subscribe to this listener-supported and donor-driven podcast. Spread the word about it. leave nice reviews and ratings on your podcast platform if you have a few minutes. And make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary and most reliable way for podcasters like me to make a living. This is my primary source of income as I'm speaking to you. All amounts are welcome, but if you or someone you know might be some kind of wealthy patron of the arts, please consider making a large monthly donation, because one or two donations like that, and things will be looking up for me. So again, please visit the Creative Control Patreon and donate today if you are able to. Thank you so much. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked and wonderful record store with bricks-and-mortar locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and great website where you can order any music you want. Say you're looking up music by The Famines or something, go to blackbird.ca, type in The Famines, and if they can get you any music by The Famines, lo and behold, they'll either put it on hold for you at the stores or they'll ship it right to your house in the mail. It's just that simple. Plus, in-kind support from independent businesses like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 859 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Raymond Biesinger with her host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Raymond. How's it going?
It is reasonable. How are you doing, Vish?
Oh, reasonable here as well. Where in the world are you?
I am in my studio in Montreal, and everyone in my house is like slightly sick and tired, so we'll see how this goes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sick and tired of you, or just sick and tired generally?
Quite possibly both. I do spend a lot of time here. But I don't know, with the changing of the seasons, everyone has some strange, like, allergetic or, like, pseudo-allergetic stuff going on, or a cold or something. So we'll see what happens.
I see. Okay. So are they all around you? Is that what you mean? Like, as we're speaking, everyone, weekday morning, but you're saying they're sick, but they're not feeling well, but you're at least you yourself are isolated from them.
I am in my studio and I work at home, and my wife is in the basement. She works in her home studio there because she's a clothing designer. And both of the children have gone to their school in Gartery, respectively. I got rid of them at about 8 this morning, maybe? Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm sorry to hear you're a little under the weather. Oh, sorry. Are you among the people feeling sick and tired?
A little bit. Yeah, totally. Okay. It's almost like someone's, like, I feel like I can't get enough sleep. Like someone's trying to poison me with sleeping pills or something.
Well, this all sounds very nefarious and like you are the victim of some plague of some kind, a deliberate. So I hope you're okay. It is lovely to speak with you again. We met, I think, for the first time ever, perhaps, in Edmonton, Alberta, which is where you're from. What was it, a couple years ago now?
Oh my gosh, like 12 years ago, 13 years ago?
No, I don't think so. When was it? Did we meet more than once? I'm referring to the time we met when I saw you with the Rolly outside of the Sadie show that you guys couldn't get into, and I managed to pull some strings or whatever and ask Sean Dean. Let's just credit Sean right now. Sean Dean from Sadie. I saw him and I said, Sean, these guys can't get in. They say it's sold out. Can you get us in? Get them in, I should say. And they, sure enough, I believe you were able to am I wrong? Am I getting this wrong? Is this right?
Okay. You have it 100% right. I moved from Montreal to Edmonton 12, 13 years ago. But then a couple of years ago, I went to Edmonton for Literary Fest, Lit Fest. And yeah, we met outside of a bar on Jasper Avenue and the Sadies were playing and you promptly got us in. And then within 5 minutes, I was feeling the like COVID era terror of being in large audiences. Yes. So I think I was in there for a grand total of 5 minutes, but I had a great time going there and going back with Rolly.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. Yes, I was wearing a mask and no one else, well, a few of us were at the time. And it was weird. It's weird when you're the only one observing the precautions, I will say, but I'm used to it now because we're all used to this now. So you had a little, not a panic attack necessarily, but sort of. Is that what you're saying?
I just wasn't ready to be around large groups of people again yet. I, you know, I dipped my little toe in and then thought, no, not for me this time.
But you were at a literary fest as well. Weren't there people there? Wasn't that a large crowd?
That was, but I was doing like an architectural walk with my co-author of 305 Lost Buildings of Canada. Mm-hmm. So we walked around like East downtown a whole lot. And so that was outdoors. And also I was doing a little session about like the finances of running an art studio. And so I knew that that wouldn't be that popular. So I had no fear about getting any sort of virus at that point.
Okay. Yeah, that, well, that's, that makes a difference if you're outdoors and whatnot. Actually, just as funny, I don't know if anyone wants to steal this idea or if it's very good, but for some reason I was daydreaming yesterday about, you know, because I have a lot of time on my hands right now. I lost my day job and I'm like, what am I going to do with my life? Mm-hmm. And how am I going to support my family beyond this kind of stuff? And I thought, I should, you get the delusion where you're like, oh, I should get into this. Maybe I should write a sitcom or something, you know, mm-hmm. where is there, of course, this is it's a stupid idea, but I was like, what if someone invented a sitcom because of the era we're in where everything happens outdoors? You never ever see the people indoors and it's filmed that way because the ventilation would be safer. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if anyone will ever, if that'll happen. Or, and I've been watching shows lately and things where I notice a lot of it is outdoors. Like if you mm-hmm. watch like, I was watching Reservation Dogs, and I feel like one of the episodes recently that I watched, all of it was outside. And I was like, I wonder if that's deliberate, like to avoid, you know what I'm getting at? You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What like COVID measures did for film and TV in terms of like how much green screen are we going to be doing and how, like, I think that there will be like video coming out, trickling out that is very like COVID era influenced for the next several years, either like culturally, like you're describing, where it's like, oh, you know, we're just used to being outside more, or just like other stuff. But that said, I'm not too good at TV stuff.
yeah, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. It's just something I was thinking about, like, how are we going to adapt? Because you go into this, by the way, before we go too much further, that bar, because you're from Edmonton, I think you're from Edmonton originally, and then you moved to Montreal. You might have said the opposite earlier as you were describing your trajectory. That's correct, right? You're from here originally, Edmonton?
Yeah, totally. But I was born in Saskatchewan, actually, in a small town.
Okay. So, and you played music for a long period. Is that correct?
Yeah, from about like 1995 to my retirement about 4 or 5 years ago.
I have a thing here. I have notes, helpful notes. You provided as a backgrounder. I'll give you some credit right away. It says here on February 20th, 2020. So what would that have been? 02-2020. Yeah, that's right. Something about numerology there, maybe. You wrote here, I had my 40th birthday and retired from performing and writing music. Now, this is on the cusp of a pandemic starting, which I noticed. And you played in a band called The Famines, who I feel like I saw a few times. Did you guys play in Halif? Who was in The Famines, first of all? Sorry, I'm all over the place today. Who was in The Famines?
Well, it was originally me and Edmonton drummer extraordinaire Garrett Kruger. And we started over there. And probably the first 6 years or so of the band, that was us. And we traveled Canada from like Victoria to Halifax maybe 4 or 5 times as a unit. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I moved to Montreal. He stayed in Edmonton. And we did a thing where he would fly over here. If we did Eastern Canada, I would fly over there. But David Suzuki wasn't happy with the carbon emissions on that one. And also, all of our money, the meager money that we would get, would be going to WestJet entirely.
Yeah.
So it was stressful. And Garrett went through some stuff. And I went through some stuff simultaneously. And I very selfishly took the band. Garrett and I are good friends again now, which is great. And then Montreal drummer Drew Damaris took over. And he stepped into it very, very quickly. And that was kind of a second lease of life on the band, because suddenly we didn't have to pay WestJet so much. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of things and started a record label of sorts, or like a publishing label called Pentagon Black, that actually outlived the band. And we probably, all told, got between Victoria and St. John's like more or less 10 or 11 times from about or 2008 to, 4 years ago.
Okay. So you were a hard touring musician and you played Guelph, Ontario, where I lived for most of my life. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. We've done at least half a dozen shows there over the years.
Yeah. So we would have been in the same rooms, but I don't recall if we... Do you recall if we'd met before this Sadie show at the Soho Club? Is that what it's called? Soho, I think?
I know. I think that we met at a cafe at one point. I was hanging out with Steph Yates during one of the visits, and she introduced me to you briefly, but it was very, very briefly.
Oh, okay. In Guelph, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You got
it. Yeah. Okay. There you go. All right. So we did meet. I thought so. Mm-hmm. I thought you looked familiar, but I was like... I don't want to say the wrong thing. You don't want to be one of these people like, don't you, who, you know, they're going to be like, oh, this guy thinks all white people look the same. You know, I didn't mean that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was going to say that Soho place. I talked to a couple people there that night and I said, this is an interesting venue. And they said, Edmonton people said, I've never been here before in my life.
Yep.
Were you familiar with that venue before
that
night?
Not in the slightest. Even like I've done kind of exhaustive research into the history of Edmonton music venues, and that thing was brand new to me. I was confused.
Yeah. Okay. So, but what'd you think? Oh, you didn't hang out long enough to really get a feel for it, I'm guessing. But I actually thought it was a nice place. I thought it was set up okay, and you know, I was also freaked out, by the way. I went to three Sadie shows. Those were like my first shows in a long time because they did a 3-night stand, not all at that place. The other two were at the Black Dog, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah.
You probably played there, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So I was freaked out too, but I it was also fun to, you know, since I moved here 4 years ago, I just don't know the city that well. So one of the main reasons you're here today is to teach me about Edmonton. you have a vested interest in architecture, I think, in urban centers, maybe. Am I mischaracterizing you in any way?
I like urban history and history in general. Like, that was my first love before I became a musician, illustrator, artist. And, I kind of naturally avoid the like large stories that Hollywood or like Toronto tells people about Canada and what it should or should not be. And I'm kind of enamored by all the smaller stories that, you know, that create the identities, of cities and the people within them.
What do you suppose compels you to have those particular interests? Sorry, before I ask you, or before we get into that, Raymond, how would you characterize what it is you actually do? I don't think we've gotten to that. We've talked about your music making, but that's not exactly why you're here today. How do you describe and characterize your work?
Well, it changes over time. And so I guess if you need to put a name on each of those things, I've been an illustrator for like 20 years full time. As that time has ticked on, I've had more and more freedom to make what I would call art. So work that comes from my heart rather than a commission from someone else. I also just barely qualify as an author because of the 305 Lost Buildings book last year that I wrote a little bit of, but it was based on a print series that I'd made. People have called me a researcher and I call myself an amateur historian. Other people sometimes call me a real historian, which I think they're really wrong about. And and all those different things come together in various ways. I guess I'm a designer too, and I'm always excited when I find like an old medium or format, like a postcard or a newsprint press or something that I can apply to very new ideas or different ideas. So I guess I'm kind of all of those things.
What's the distinction between a professional and an amateur historian? You are a published historian, ostensibly. You have this best-selling book, 305 Lost Buildings of Canada. I mean, what's the... Come on, man. Don't be modest. I think you are a historian.
I think that because it came through the University of Alberta and there's a lot of academic historians there, and they just have a certain level of academic standards that they need to follow. And I'm kind of lucky because I'm an artist and I can always do the artistic liberties thing. So when I was drawing like Lost Buildings of Canada, if I needed to change something to prove a point or change a perspective slightly to make it fit the format, I could do that. And that kind of thing would make a real historian blanch. Or like, say I have this collection that I call Paper Cities, and I'm enamored with different pictorial and illustrated views of Canadian cities going back 150 years. And some are just amazing. And so I've started finding like public domain ones and high res versions of them and cleaned them up and fixed them a little bit and then made them available to people again. Yeah. And again, that's something that an actual professional historian would never feel comfortable doing, like adding any element of commercialism or retouching a thing to a historic object.
Yeah.
But again, as someone who just appreciates them as art and, you know, hopefully feels is qualified to retouch them, given my history as an illustrator and my concern for aesthetics, I get to go into some spaces that your standard historian can't get into. For example, this project is something I came up with a couple of years ago. I was collaborating with the trans woman historian and author and writer Stacey Easton, who I've worked with for 20 years or so. So we did a print called Great Plains Queer. And so it examines the space between Edmonton and Texas and explains queer history in that space. And in queer history, like the coasts, the giant cities are very well documented. And you can find books that have like references to other books and to notes and memoirs, all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so you can write a conventional history using that. But with the Great Plains, it's completely different because historically, you know, it's 1880 and you're a queer person. You do not wish to leave evidence of your queerness. You do not wish to leave written words behind. And so in this kind of space, it takes the form more of an oral history or a community history or like that's spoken or like rumors. And you have a choice then to either accept these as history or not have history at all. And so this map uses all of that information. And again, if I was a quote unquote real historian, that would probably cause some concern. I guess 20 years ago, it would cause a lot of concern. But nowadays, there are more forms of history being accepted as real. But yeah, so again, it lets me go into some pretty strange and interesting places. In that case, you know, I got to draw a hand job in a men's bathroom stall at the University of North Dakota. Yeah. And so I get to be an artist and a weirdo and a historian all mushed into one thing that's almost like beyond critique because I'm not any of these things specifically.
Right. Now, as someone who makes tangible products in an era where that's becoming more rare, you could be making making historical artifacts. So in your adaptation of history, do you have a, you know, you mentioned how historians might blanch at some of the work you do and how you do it. Does it give you pause to think like, yeah, I did this little sort of satire of history almost or adaptation of historical stuff in my work. At some point, 100 years from now, someone might find this and assume it's real. It's true. You might be the Marty McFly of history. You might illustrated history. You might modify and alter the course of people's understanding of this moment in time. Have you ever thought that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that notion. Like my goal is almost to create an object that captures like a niche community or niche scene, like Great Plains Queer or Edmonton's music scene, and have it be an object that someone can find in 100 years and hopefully realize the limitations of it, but also accept that it is in some cases, the only documentation of a thing. Like I did a chart a long time ago called Edmonton, a chronology of Edmonton bands 1950 to 2010. Mm-hmm. And it started out as like a community memory exercise where I asked every musician I knew, what bands have you been in? Who was in those bands? What is their contact information? And this game of telephone went back like to the barn dance scene in the 1940s. And the resulting chart was like, there's nothing like it. I think a lot of people have ambitions to make something like that when they're in the music scene. But because of my like aesthetic skill and that I can do rudimentary research and, you know, have a printer here and that kind of thing, it was me who managed to put all these elements together.
Yeah.
And also as far as like the republishing of things, just yesterday I ran into an Edmonton map. And it's kind of a funny one because it's one of the first Edmonton maps ever produced. It was the original was from 1883. And I just found this on the Internet Archive, like a high resolution. Hmm. And so it's just a standard like it's like Edmonton downtown because Strathcona was its own city at that point. It wasn't included in this. Well, it was a town at the time. But there's just this map with like land holdings and a few buildings sketched in. It's from 1883 and it's like Dominion Lands Corporation. And then the thing is, it's framed by this black key line. And then up at the very top, there's this very old-timey, like what you consider like Hollywood Western typeface. And it says, Souvenir Map of Edmonton, 1882, brought to you by Nordraft. Hmm. And I was like, what is this? So basically, it was an 1883 map that in the 1970s or 60s, an Edmonton art supply company and drafting supply company called Nordraft had taken from the archives and republished, erroneously put that it was from 1882, and put like their business information around the frame. And now I have taken this again and I have, you know, cleaned it up a little bit and contextualized it with some words and put it on my website. So it's these layers and layers of people interpreting and putting their own little like twist on stuff.
Right.
That's kind of fascinating. It's like you can almost read two books at once with this kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, and this is I guess I haven't really thought about this too much, but like the notion of tangible history being more precise than oral history is maybe a misnomer. I mean, both are adaptable. Both can change. Both are in the hands of whoever's doing the capturing. So
yeah,
it's quite fascinating. I mean, earlier I started to ask you what compelled you to explore history, and then I sidetracked myself. I want to go back to that question to figure out your sort of origins as both an amateur and I would say now an established historian. But I think also as we're speaking, I want to ask you about what you suppose has caused you to gravitate towards marginalized communities in history. I was quite struck by the text in your book, 305 Lost Buildings of Canada, particularly in its references to Indigenous culture and Indigenous history and how settlers came in and changed things and altered the landscape and all this sort of stuff. And as you're speaking now and your exploration of queer country and queer communities, I mean, the marginalized communities as part of the historical record, like I think you see a certain responsibility in trying to reflect those experiences and those innovations and those, you know, that origin, the origin of a landscape as much as the architecture and whatnot. Sorry, long-winded question. Let's get to it. What do you suppose has compelled you to study history and use it in your work and then further through that to try to explore and reflect marginalized communities at the same time? Can you speak to that?
Well, so when I first went to university, my marks were very bad. And I love that Alberta in the 1990s didn't have high standards for students. So I got in and what did I do? At first, I was a drama major and a film studies minor. And that lasted a year and a half. And I failed. I think that with the drama minor, that when it came to like play analysis, I failed a course. And then in the like performance end, I had to wear a leotard and I just wasn't going to do that. I wasn't ready for that as a human being.
Sure.
So, and then I caught mono twice, which, it's stereo if you get it twice. You get it?
Yes, I do get it. That's good. That's a little joke for our audio mixing friends. That's very good. Yeah.
There we go. And so I had about a year off where I laid in bed. And when I came back, I was like, okay, I have to stop dicking around. What am I good at marks wise? And I had taken like an elective history course and that was my best mark out of everything. So I was like, I'm going to do this. So I took a whole bunch of history courses, did all right, flirted with being an honors student. And then I fell into the student newspaper, The Gateway.
Oh, yeah.
From there, I was excited about like covering campus news, campus events. And I fell in with like independent music. And I was thrilled by like the hyper-local music that no one else was listening to. And, or that, you know, wouldn't be on Much Music. And so I did a I did the like on tour with the band thing to Calgary once with a band called Les Tabernacles. One of the guys in that band, Alan, is still a great friend and lives in Montreal now. Mm. And that was like eye opening. And then I started like making art for bands. And I was studying like European social history of the last century, which is like rich with ideas of the welfare state and socialism and helping people out. And so I guess at that point I became like a student journalist, kind of activist thinky guy in Alberta in the 90s. And it was a situation where like the Alberta government has a long history of being hostile towards arts types. And so I felt very, you know, all of our friends felt very like constantly at odds with the government in a very serious way. And at that same time, there's a very, very important person for the development of my artistic and social life. Trevor Anderson adopted me. And these days, he is, I would say, Canada's preeminent queer filmmaker. He just came out with a movie, his first feature called Before I Change My Mind 2 years ago. And he's won some really nice awards in the States and Europe and here. Anyway, I highly recommend you check out his work. But one day, we knew each other just from around, and then he just abducted me in a van and took me to Value Village, and we joked about starting a band together, and we actually started a band called the Vertical Struts. And Trevor was very, very gay, and me very, very straight, and well, not very, but I'm there. And it basically, the queer community adopted me as the pet straight boy. And so that was kind of a big deal for me. And it really, between all the stuff I was studying in school, all the niche news, all the niche music, and then being introduced to this community. And also, I think just being the youngest brother of three, and my brothers were very, very mean to me. And I kind of have just always sought the underdog. And to me, in, the smaller cultures are the underdogs of the world, the niche cultures. And, I use the word punk to describe myself, although I come from a very different place than traditional punk. But it's that sympathy with anarchism and the less popular paths traveled culturally. All that stuff excites me. And I'm really, really, I'm thrilled that the queer community is good with working with me. Yeah. And I'm thrilled when I get to work with wonderful, wonderful skilled people like Chris Murdoch, who we put out the Black Dots pamphlet about his encounters with being a black kid in the punk scene and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled that I can use my skills to kind of make other people's stories look really good and sometimes actually make a little bit of money for them and me in the process.
Well, that's wonderfully put, and I relate to a lot of what you're saying, and I wonder if you have any perspective on the kind of, Venn diagram between curiosity that you're exhibiting and that you exhibited and continue to exhibit, curiosity, but also a feeling that you're not being told the whole story. So, I gravitated towards underground culture after being pretty ensconced in sort of mainstream culture, and... Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us who came of age, I was 12, 13 when punk supposedly broke in 1991. Mm-hmm. And that's a very formative time. And I feel fortunate because I was just coming out of a full bore FM radio, obsessed with U2 and whatever else was going on. And then something changed and I was like, wait a minute, there's a whole version of the world that I didn't know about. When I started going to record stores and buying fanzines and listening to different music and reading interviews, and you're like, oh, they lied to me or something. they didn't tell me about this part of, they just told me about NXS and whatever else, U2 and all the bigger bands. There's a whole other world here. It sounds like did you have that kind of revelation when you discovered the stuff you discovered? Wait a minute. Did you have that moment?
Yeah, well, it's funny. My wife and I were really similar in a lot of ways. And one thing that both of us are total non-joiners. If anyone suggests we should do something or wants us to do something or check out a show or something, our immediate response will be no. And we will probably check it out in about 6 years or so. And I think one thing that the independent music thing in Edmonton was exciting is no one was forcing it down my throat. No one was trying to sell it to me. It was work to participate. It was a challenge to get into it and find information about it. And so I think maybe just that knee jerk, if someone's telling me to check something out, I avoid it. If no one's telling me to check something out, I dig into it. It could be an example of that. But I used to work at Sam the Record Man in West Edmonton Mall a million years ago. And wow, was I ignorant of what people were into. And all the bands that I was enthused about were, didn't even have records. And I was possibly the worst record store employee that you've ever seen.
It sounds like music. And first of all, are you, when you say you guys aren't joiners, are you contrarian? or are you just know-it-alls? Like, what do you think is going on there?
I think that, like my wife has been designing clothes and making clothes for decades, and I've been doing this thing. And I think that, in a way, both of us are just too busy producing stuff to really digest stuff.
Right.
It's almost like we hardly have enough time to make the visions that we produce happen. And so the idea of spending like some time really, really looking at what other people are making or like doing, we just can't find the time to do it. Does okay. that make any sense?
No. I'm the same. People are like, hey, did you listen to the podcast? I'm like, I'm too busy making them to spend too much time listening as much as I used to. And I always feel like, does that make me sound like a jerk? I'm literally talking to people and editing the conversations and putting them out. And then, you know, all the other stuff I have to do, that it's rare that I have downtime to actually listen to anything but music or read a book or, you know, I'm just constantly consuming things that I guess my thing. Okay. So my experience with it is different. The people telling me this, they have work to do too, but they're consuming my show and they assume that that means I'm consuming other shows. And my thing is like, I'm at my limit. I'm trying to process Raymond's books and art, and I'm trying to process a billion records that are just out and, you know, lyrics and music, and I need to talk about them. So I think this is actually a bit of a shock to people who listen to my show when they hear people like you and I talk about this. Like, we're kind of full up on we're stimulated. We've got a lot of content to deal with. So the idea of listening to other people's stuff or viewing it, I mean, I don't know about you, but I also sometimes worry that it'll cloud my ability to do my own thing by listening to.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, musicians say this all the time. Like, honestly, I'm so busy making records and writing songs that if I spend too much time listening to other people's, then it's going to kind of impose itself upon my practice. Is that, you can relate to that?
Absolutely. Like other modern illustrators and artists, I really don't pay attention to what they do. Mostly, it started out as like jealousy issues. Like I would see someone else, some other illustrator's portfolio online, and however large my list of people who I'd worked with, if they had one person on their list that I hadn't, I would just be like, and just have like a horrible feeling. So I stopped looking at what other people were doing. And I think that as well insulates you to a certain extent from copying people without thinking about
That's amazing candor you're displaying there, because the insecurity, jealousy stuff is certainly probably part of it. I feel like I'm past it. I feel like I'm past it, but it can be frustrating if you're at all competitive to be like, God damn it, I've been chasing this Kim Gordon interview for weeks or months or years, and then, you know, time comes that she's kind of circulating again, and then she does other stuff and not your stuff, and you're like, what the hell? And you can't, you also, I mean, in my case, the humility kicks in, like, yeah, I'm not as big or as prominent as the thing she did. I'm not even a consideration, you know, on some level. Mm-hmm. By the way, by the time people hear this, I don't know if Kim's going to be on the show or not. I still, since it could be, we're talking about this, and she's finally appeared on the show. She's one of my white whale guests, if you will. You know, someone I've always wanted on the show or wanted to talk to in all of Sonic Youth. She's the only one I've never talked to. So anyway, sorry about this. This is a real tangent. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to get at your motivations. Hey, thanks for listening to Creative Control, as always. As you may have heard me mention, I recently lost my day job, and I've had a few conversations with people since who've said, you had a day job? I thought your podcast was your day job. When I explained why it hasn't been my day job to a friend, he suggested I should share some of this information with people like you listening right now. So, in short, unless they have some giant exclusive million-dollar contract, podcasters are not paid to make stuff by companies like Apple and Spotify. Podcasters do not make any money from streaming royalties. Ad revenue is dependent on a certain threshold of downloads each month, and even if your show is accessed 30,000 times a month, the income you get is actually really minimal. So podcasters like me usually make time in our lives to support our communities and our interests to make these shows, and our most reliable source of income for this work is in fact crowdfunding. In my case, it's my Patreon. So if you'd like to receive ad-free episodes earlier than everyone else, regular newsletters and blog posts, bonus audio content, and support my work, quite literally, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You know, I asked you, I referenced your retirement from music in 2020, but you keep bringing up music, and I think that's telling. Did we establish why you decided you would stop? You wrote, I retired from performing and writing music on my 40th birthday, and like you said, February 20th, 2020. Some prescience there, given that a pandemic was coming up, and live music, I think the feeling has probably changed for most of us, like just to be in a room, it's a bit different. Did you answer the question? Why was that your end date?
I didn't, but yeah, my timing was really good. My wife was just about to give birth to our second kid, and I personally just don't think that I could be an adequate, like a good partner and a feminist if, you know, leaving her at home to watch the kids while I went out to ostensibly party for no money on random weekends.
Right.
I think, too, it was easier for me just knowing that I had this whole other creative outlet that actually pays the bills that I could step back to. And I've kind of always been an all or nothing kind of guy. So it was like, I'm not going to accept some kind of truncated version of playing music or just like, you know, it's great for a lot of people. It's awesome. I love people just doing what they love in all their shapes and forms. But for me, it just wouldn't have given me satisfaction. So it's been really interesting to take the time that I used to put into that and put it entirely into the visual arts thing. And yeah, use it as fodder and subject matter to reflect upon in like a visual way or a textual way as well.
Yeah. So,
and also the cultural or like the things I've learned through like 20 years of being a DIY musician, like that was almost the perfect crash course for functioning as a like independent creative working in the visual world. Like these two things for me have developed side by side, and I was always taking lessons and skills from one and applying it to the other and back and forth. Yeah.
Do you miss music making at all? Like the actual act of making music?
No, it was always really stressful for me. I hated writing songs. I despised the recording studio every single time. And I liked, when I wrote a song that I liked, I could play it forever and ever and ever. I had a very long attention span for it. But as far as like the worrying about people showing up for shows and putting on shows and all the worries, I had enough of those things. I have enough worries with other stuff in my life that I don't need to bring on more like that.
It is so weird not, right, when the thing you love and the thing that gives you a lot of satisfaction has this commensurate amount of work and stress that follows it. Like, for example, I am the same. I play a little guitar, at least, it is a tiny guitar. I wasn't being specific. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean size-wise, but it is actually a small guitar. I play guitar every day, and every once in a while, you are mindlessly like, oh, I got a little progression here. Okay, now I have two parts for something. What am I doing with this? And you just play it endlessly. I'm almost completely satisfied just coming up with that. Mm-hmm. The idea, and similarly, like, I'm enjoying speaking with you right now, Raymond, and mm-hmm. we are recording this, and it's going well, I think I'm enjoying this conversation. After mm-hmm. we're done, I got to put it together. I got to mm-hmm. put it out. I got to, like, do a bunch of stuff, and that's, it's part of the deal, but it's not the main, what I like is this moment. And think what you're saying maybe is you like the moments where you come up with the song, but then you have to think about as the record, oh, we got to go to the recording studio. How long mm-hmm. is it going to take to record this song properly? What does properly even mean? Mm-hmm. I said, are anyone going to buy the record? Oh, is anyone going to show up for the show? There's an inherent anxiety in making stuff, isn't there? In terms of like publicly, I mean.
Totally, totally. And like there are so many like random factors in music and so many other people that like you need to rely on so many people. And I just don't have a heart for that anymore. Like every once in a while, I think that there might be some kind of support role that I can still have, like with Pentagon Black and the compilations that we did. And if you know about them or don't know about them, they're like, I combine my love of like print. And so I'd get these giant newsprint posters made with like download code for music on them. And we made a bunch of compilations of bands from across Canada, and you'd buy the print and it'd get mailed to you. And then you would download the music, and then you'd hear about all this great new Canadian music. So like that kind of thing I really enjoyed and seemed like way less risky than like getting in a van. And like, I can definitely see myself doing that again at some point. And I even have some ridiculous ideas for new compilations that I just might release as like me and my art studio. So yeah, there might be some kind of support role in my future of the parts that I know only I can do well, to be too full of myself, but I bring a very specific set of skills to this.
Yeah.
And yeah, I like the idea of helping other people get their songs out and get their culture out and get their music out. And and I also just like the chaos, like as much as I don't want to like work it amidst the chaos or like try to make it work financially, I love the energy and the wildness and the openness that the DIY music scenes across Canada bring and give. Like that is beautiful and something that I am not aware of other sources of.
Yeah, I mean, I will say I want to thank you. Again, everyone, Raymond and I met on the street in Edmonton briefly, and then we struck up a correspondence about Raymond coming up on the show. By the way, Raymond, this, I just told the story on the show because Rolly, Cadence Weapon, has a new album coming out, and we had a talk, and your name came up.
Oh,
I was like, I owe Raymond an email, and Raymond sent me these beautiful poster prints and a book and those Pentagon Black informational pamphlets. You sent me those. It was all very, very fascinating and interesting. I just want to say I appreciate the gesture, but I also really appreciated the work. Mm-hmm. And I continue to appreciate the work. I had a couple of appointments yesterday, and I brought 305 Lost Buildings of Canada along with me as I waited to, you know, those appointments to happen. It was just really fun, actually, to, as you may have guessed, or maybe you would think, I wanted to check out what the book had to say about Guelph, Ontario.
And
I wanted
to
check out what the book had to say about Edmonton. And as someone who's been to St. John's, Newfoundland, I found that section really, really interesting. You know what? Before I get to where I was going with this, which was mm-hmm. to ask you about the Canadian Music Venues print mm-hmm. series and the fact that even though you're not making music anymore, as you say, you have a passion for music and helping people with music. And I think the Canadian Music Venues print series and these Pentagon Black pamphlets reveal that. What I haven't talked to you about yet is this best-selling book, 305 mm-hmm. Lost Buildings of Canada. Can you give us a little insight about who's involved with that book and where that concept came from before we get to things like the Canadian Music Venues project and other things?
Absolutely. So maybe in 2012, like after I'd moved to Montreal, I really wanted to get to know Montreal and surrounding areas as much as I knew Alberta. And so I made four prints of four different cities, Montreal, Toronto, Ottawa, and Quebec City. Each one showed them during a specific point in their history, and it focused on their architecture. So like the Montreal one would be Montreal on the opening day of Expo 67, Toronto on the opening day of the CN Tower. And each one was like black and gray and very like cubist, geometric, very detail heavy. All the buildings were just like rendered in these more or less squares. And they had between like 50 and 75 buildings in each of them. And those were kind of, they will put my daughter through college, which is great. Oh, nice. Yeah, like 10 years later, people are still very excited about them. And so after I did that, by about 2017 or so, I was taking another look at them. And I realized that my favorite buildings were those that no longer existed, that I had drawn for these images, but were no longer there. So I did a little bit of research and I thought, oh, you know, Montreal's history. There's so many demolished buildings. And so I made a Montreal print that called, it was called like 18 Lost Buildings of Montreal, but in French. And I made sure to like have each of the buildings represented. They had to have stood within living memory, definition I eventually stretched. The buildings had to be from a variety of different social backgrounds and have different like cultural purposes. So it couldn't just be like 18 buildings that rich people lived in, because those are incredibly documented and there are photos everywhere because rich people love documenting themselves. You know, it would be like the synagogue that used to be in modern day Chinatown that got bulldozed for Chinatown back in 1919. Or it would be like the Rockhead's Paradise in Little Burgundy, which was like a black jazz core for Canada in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Mm. So like all these different social purposes, there'd be some stadiums. Anyway, people were really excited about that. And when people are excited about something I'm excited about, my wife always jokes that I serialized the shit out of it. So I made Lost Buildings of Montreal, Lost Buildings of Quebec, Lost Buildings of Toronto, Edmonton, Calgary, blah, blah, blah. Eventually, there's 30-some prints in the series going all the way down to Austin, Texas. And by about 2019, I was burnt out on the project and ready to move on to the next thing. But I saw a feature in the Globe and Mail, Alex Bezikovic, who I didn't know, he was their architecture critic, had written a feature that was basically like Lost Buildings of Canada, but slightly reworded. And on the cover of the feature was this Broadway theater in Saskatoon, which is this beautiful, beautiful theater that was bulldozed in the 70s in Saskatoon. And I'd never seen it before. And so I read his feature and I dropped him an email and was like, hey, blah, blah, blah. This is what I've been doing. Thanks for showing me this. It seems like we're interested in a lot of the same things. We should work together on something sometime, maybe. And I fully didn't expect to hear back from him, but he got back to me. And then in classic my style, where I propose an idea and then I get cold feet on it, and then some kind of enthusiastic other person is like, no, we have to do that. That's what Alex did. So we took all the Canadian drawings, which I added some to, and it was all my building selections. And then Alex wrote up everything. And I was very flattered because, I mean, his full-time job is I write and think about architecture. Yeah. And he only had one addition to my list of 305 buildings. So that felt good. And then, I wrote a big chunk of the intro and a whole bunch of the blurbs. It turns out I'm good at little like taglines. Oh, taglines. I got you covered. And then eventually we found an agent through some contacts of Alex's. We had eight different publishers bidding on it, but they're like Canadian nonfiction publishers. So It's like they were saying, we'll buy you pizza. Well, we'll buy you pizza twice. So not big money. And then, it turns out that we had some pretty good like pre-sale ground game to get all jargony on you. Yeah. But the first run of 3,000 books sold out the day before our actual release date, which was fascinating and amazing. And then it's on its third print run now. And that's kind of exciting. So that's where it came from and where it went. And there's been like constant back and forth with the publisher about like, oh, we could do Lost Buildings, Alberta, BC, Ontario, and this kind of thing. And Alex is like, I'm a busy guy who can't afford to work for pizza. And I'm like, I like pizza. So there might be some more in that series. Oh. We'll see.
It's so funny that people assume that if you wrote a book, you're pulling in the money. And meanwhile, there's no money at all. You get pizza, which is, as people who know, I have a pizza sponsorship, for crying out loud. I love pizza. We have pizza night. My wife and I make 4 pizzas, and the kids sometimes eat them. It's really fun. So I appreciate that. And I just want to say it's a remarkable contribution to Canadian history. I don't know if you've been approached or have any knowledge if this book has been adopted in academia or among academics. Have you heard anything like that?
I know that a lot of people have it, and a lot of, like, it's gotten in a lot of places. I don't think it's on anyone's, like, course packs or whatever. I don't think anyone needs to buy it for a course or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I know it's gotten around really well, and it's being taken very seriously. It has a tone that I really like, that I like to describe as informal but informed. And that kind of lets it exist in a lot of different worlds. Yeah, I like that tone, and I look forward to deploying it on some future projects too.
No, I'm hoping I can convince both my kids to read it. My daughter is really into illustrations and loves graphic, just constantly drawing, and my son likes history, so I'm gonna see if I can sneak this into their I'll switch it. I read to my daughter still. My son, I don't know what he's doing up there, but he's like, no, I'm fine. I'll read whatever. Anyway, I'm going to try and bring this to their attention because I think they'll enjoy it. It's wonderful. So can we talk about the Canadian Music Venues print series? I don't know if it exactly relates to what we were just talking about. Are they, how would you distinguish them, or how would you say they're related?
That one, I think that it's funny because, I mean, to give a brief overview, the Canadian Music Venues Project, it's 9 different prints, each one showing one of the 9 largest cities in Canada. But it's like a street pattern, like the streets.
Yeah.
The streets are named. And each one has between like 100 and 200 and some music venues from their past, indicated by an arrow. It has the venue name, it has their addresses and the approximate years they were active.
Yeah.
And it also reflects like all genres of music. I didn't want it to just be like indie rock or whatever. But I think that it grew from the Lost Buildings Project.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to look at the demolished buildings of Canada, you're going to run into a lot of music venues, because musicians function in these spaces that are, you know, low budget zones, you know, on the edge of habitability, you know, always about to be condemned. And so I think I ran into a lot of like show posters and old venues during Lost Buildings. And I started wondering where those were in Montreal. So I put together the music venues map of Montreal. And as per my wife's prediction, when something is received well, I serialize it.
Yeah.
And
no,
it quickly became a full series.
Totally. It's very wise of you. And well, I don't know if your wife is criticizing you necessarily, but it's wise. Like if people go to your website, and I'll link to this, of course, but yeah, you got Halifax, Edmonton. What do we got here? Montreal, Toronto. Like, it's remarkable. Like Vancouver, like, this is great. You picked most of the major Canadian cities, Ottawa, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable idea. And these do well for you? Like, are people appreciative? Beyond, I don't mean in a crass way, but like, are people appreciative of this?
Oh, I'll go crass way and say yeah. And yeah, it's like, I think that a lot of people, like the venues that they participated in or were around, it's like, you know, history doesn't record these places, and people are generally thrilled when there is a monument to what they've, you know, what they participated in, what they played at. You know, I'll get an email from someone who's like, dad worked at a venue in the 1980s or 70s, and be like, oh, this is going to be so great in his rumpus room. And people are just thrilled to be remembered when they're doing marginal cultural activities like this.
Yeah.
And like, it's also just fascinating to learn these like larger narratives where it's like, okay, so let's say a venue was a movie theater in the 1920s. Well, that meant that it was most likely an opera house as well. It would have like vaudeville acts and singing, and because, you know, no one was going to put on a record or have a DJ. And so basically the movie theaters of the 20s were music venues as well.
Yeah.
And then in the 1930s, you know, talkies came in and the movie theaters stopped booking like vaudeville stuff. And then in the 50s, those places, a lot of them stopped showing movies and became strip clubs. But the strip clubs early on would have live bands playing. And then these strip clubs turn into live music venues more than strip clubs. And then they stop with the stripping because there's a cultural backlash. And then they're music clubs. And then they fold. There's just these neat narratives that you see playing out in every city that is really exciting. And there's also stuff like you'll find these outliers. Like in Winnipeg, the like counterculture 60s rock scene all played out in like suburban hotel lounges, like down the Pembinan Highway in like South Winnipeg. And, you know, you always think about like indie is like your independent music is like this downtown grungy thing. But no, it's like, yeah, that kind of thing happening. Or like the huge like dance scene in the 1940s and 50s, that kind of thing. It's just, it's fascinating to like examine the play places of people who basically were me and other musicians, but like 60 years ago, 70 years ago, and all the different like forces at work behind where they were playing and why they were playing there.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating reading about the way people use spaces and how they're like, you're just referencing how a place might have been an opera house. Then it became a movie theater. Then it became a strip club. Then it became a music venue. Then it went back to being some sort of multi-purpose space. Like there's a there's a venue in Guelph that we didn't really go to very often. It was called at one point Club Denim. And it was aptly named. Like Lee Aaron would play there or whatever. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And who, for those who don't know, she was like a kind of sort of like Canadian mainstream rocker, like mainstream metal, if that makes any sense. But we would not go there very often. Now it's called the Guelph Concert Theater. Mm-hmm. But then I read in your book, in the book, about how I think you referenced the fact that it's now a Guelph Community Health Center. That whole that whole building is now known as that, and that's true. But it's still a concert venue. And anytime I did go there, the history of the place did occur to me, like, oh, this must have been an opera house. Mm-hmm. The floor is slanted in a way that maybe this was a movie theater at one point. It's just fascinating how humans will use a space, and you and people like you documenting the shift in basically sociological taste, how that evolves and how something is in fashion. Like the same space would house all these different modes of expression, I guess. As public tastes change. And I mean, we go through that all the time. We went through that in the 90s where the indie rock club becomes a dance club, sometimes on the same day. On the same day, hey, indie rock band, get out of here. We got to get the club night going. You know, we got to get all the clean people in. You dirty sons of guns, get out of here.
Yeah, and early show.
Yeah. So I just want to say, like, I find your work really rewarding. And it's really important to me, and I think others who don't know it should check out your work, Raymond. So I just want to take a moment to thank you for this. I'm fascinated by the same things as you, and I really find it interesting. So on that note, you know, we've talked a lot about stuff you've done. What's coming up next for you?
Oh, boy. I have a book proposal out with four different publishers right now, and it is called 9 Times My Work Has Been Ripped Off. And it's again, like I speak of like how like functioning as a DIY musician has affected my career as a visual artist and illustrator. And so it really is at play here, because basically since I started being a full-time illustrator back in like 2005, I've identified 9 different times in which my like work, you know, be it an image or my labor in making a piece of work, someone has attempted to steal it. And so, and what I've done in response to it. And so just like in any community that isn't really served by any sort of justice system, that community is going to make their own methods of finding justice. So in terms of being an illustrator, it's like the amounts of, like, I might work with like 50 different people over the course of a year, and each of those invoices that I send out to those people might be worth between $400 and $10,000. And basically all of those sums are too small for the justice system to make sense of it. Like, you can't take it to court. You know, the law is like floating uselessly overhead. Yeah. And so the book basically is my attempts and efforts to get justice as an independent artist. And so it might be like at one point the Royal Canadian Mint ripped off a bunch of my illustrations when they phased out the penny. And I went toe-to-toe with the giant advertising firm Cossette that ran that campaign and got them to pull it. Or it might be like this giant Toronto NGO. It's like a business incubator and worth a couple billion dollars. Used one of my illustrations for like 3 years on some of their corporate communications. Huh. And someone pointed that out to me and I got a settlement out of them. So there's that kind of thing where it's like the court doesn't matter, but you need to find other ways to get stuff done. Or like this is the first instance of being ripped off that I outline in this book is from 2005. And so I was broke, and just starting out. I actually have notes of how much money I was making per month that summer. And it was like $350, $400, $700. Right. And all this is, according to StatsCan, that is called deep poverty.
Right.
And so I made I was making some show posters at the time. And someone in Ottawa was like, hey, can you make a show poster for me? And I was like, yeah, sure, $50. And they're like, sounds great. So I make the poster and send it to them. And then they just refused to pay me. Hmm. And like now, you know, modern 2024 Raymond, $50, I'd be annoyed, but you know, it's not a big deal. But at that time, that was a huge deal for me.
Yeah.
And so this person and I just went back and forth and like they used the poster. They were like, I'm so poor, I can't pay you. And I was like, I'm so poor, I can't get not paid. And eventually I had to get creative. And so I invented a fictional collection agency in Ottawa that charged the person who was needed to pay. They charged them their fee as well. So I was like, oh yeah, these guys are going to come and like make you pay me $50 and they're going to charge you $150 for the pleasure of collecting that money from you unless you send that money, you know, express by this Friday. And so I got the $50 and I was and remain as ignorant about how collection agencies work now as I was then. And this other person was ignorant as well. And so I kind of took advantage of that to get what was due to me. And you won't find that advice in any business book.
But you are a punk. That's like, amazing. That's an amazing way of getting you get what you want. That's amazing.
Yeah. So I think that this kind of like financial creative self-help book like doesn't exist in this world.
Yeah.
And like, It's something that I think directly I'm pointing this book proposal at photographers and illustrators and designers, but I've talked to like drag performers about it and filmmakers and like so many different kinds of people who are very excited about this because it's the kind of conversation no one has and everyone's legal advice is like pretty much garbage when it comes to independent creative commerce and stuff like that.
Well, it seems especially pertinent as we deal with AI and all this stuff. And, you know, I'm conscious of this too, and I'm not the best at it, but sometimes when I'm promoting a guest on the show and I'm using photos, I do my best to credit the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you can't, they're not on Instagram or whatever, and you can't really somehow, but I think photographers, graphic illustrators, I mean, I think we just all take them for granted.
Yeah.
In terms of credit.
Totally. So, and there's also like some cultural things behind that too. Like you and me coming through the 1990s and like grunge culture and like slacker culture and like anti-money thought and stuff like that. And I completely agree. Like fuck the giant corporations, fuck the giant capitalists and all that stuff. But like, if I'm going to function as an artist and be able to build on my skills, I need to get paid. I need a stable existence.
Yeah.
And so since day one, I've looked at what I do creatively as like creative labor and like labor in a classic, like socialist sense. And like my goal is to have better labor conditions and working conditions for laborers like myself. And so this book is kind of like trying to do that for creative types. And it's like, it's really neat where in like, 2005, the book is about that poster. After that, there's some local ripoffs. And then there's like this state gambling corporation in Hungary that used some of my images. And wild stuff. And then like, Royal Canadian Mint, giant nonprofits. There's a COVID era design studio that went under where I actually did call a real collection agency on someone. Anyway, and that one was like, And my intent is as well to interview some of the people that were my adversaries in this and get their opinions and ideas of what was happening. And I definitely want it to be about more than myself. That said, it's kind of funny that for all this book is, it's almost like it's like I'm sneaking in a memoir as well.
Well, of course. Yeah. It's about your own work history as well. I mean, this sounds, again, this sounds like essential reading and I'm very compelled to read it. I hope it gets published and that maybe you can come back on the show if you've enjoyed yourself today and we can talk about that too.
That sounds great. I would love that. And I the four publishers I've sent are amazing. And so far, they've responded with enthusiasm, but we'll see what they can do.
Right, because I assume there might be some, you're calling some people out. There might be some liability or something in that.
Well, I've intentionally kept stuff anonymous. So I've told you more about the names of people involved than I include, because I think that like telling the story is more important than calling people out. Yeah, there's a lot of anonymous. And also, what's so fun is like every third page in the book is a full page illustration. So I get to draw all this stuff as well, which is so fun.
Nice.
So it's kind of, and also it's going to be black and white and a soft cover. So it's like an affordable like handbook that is accessible and gorgeous because it's hard times for people in the independent commercial creative arts. And yeah, I would like for this thing to get read and to help people.
Well, as I say, for what it's worth, Raymond, I feel like you're doing really noble and fascinating work. So I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for this time. If people want to learn more about you, I know you have this wonderful website. Can you give us a sense of where you'd like people to go to follow you using, you know, modern technology?
Oh, there's just my website that is kind of an umbrella for everything is just 15.ca and you spell out 15 and .ca.
What I meant to ask you about that and I'm glad we got to this point. Why is your work website called 15.ca?
Because it is really, really, really easy to mess up the I and the E in my last name. So back when the internet was young, I examined the idea of getting Biesinger.com and Biesinger.ca. But decided against it, and I just went through the numbers, spelling them out on the internet in .ca, and that was the first one that was available.
What? Really? So there's a 1 through 14 .ca, and that's it?
People
that's
had
the
those.
Significance? Wow.
Yeah. That is really... And then, I just wanted something neutral and easy to remember. And it's funny when people are like, oh, and we're talking to Raymond Biesinger from 15 Studios. And it's like, no. It's just so that you can not have to figure out how my last name is spelled.
Wow. Just totally random, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could have just as easily been 17.ca. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, then I would have been mistaken for like a young woman's magazine.
Oh, yes, that's true. That would have maybe not been the best course. Or even 16. Yeah, you're right. 15 is good. You're in the sweet spot. I don't think we refer to 15 as anything. That's great. All right. Okay.
I do find it kind of funny because I love doing things deliberately. And that is one major choice that I made without any sort of knowledge of like what I wanted to do or conceptually achieve it. And there it is.
Yeah. What about like Instagram or something? You want people to follow you on that?
Yeah, I think I'm just Raymond Biesinger Instagram something. You can just link to it from my website there.
Yeah.
There's a link at the bottom.
I will do. Anything? Awesome. Sorry, were you saying something there? Did I catch you?
I have like two super ridiculous things to say. One, at one point I did think that I wanted Biesinger.com. I thought like, I'm ready for this. My people know I's and E's better than they ever have in the past. And I found the .com registrar and they just didn't respond to my emails. It was some like company in like, I think it was Singapore who was like squatting on it. Oh. And then I got in touch with like a domain broker in Las Vegas of all places. And I was like, hey, I want this URL. Is there any chance you can get that for me? And the guy like called me and was like, let me check it out. And he checks it out and he gets back to me. He's like, okay, Raymond, I think we could have it for $40,000.
Jesus.
And I was like, what? Like, I'm just like a Canadian like art illustration guy. And like, I was thinking maybe $500, but $40,000. And then he said the best line in the world, which I love so much. He's like, Raymond, I don't want you to think about what you are now, but I want you to think about what you're going to be.
Over a website domain that costs $40,000? Yeah. Good Lord.
Totally. So the broker was like such a good motivational coach, but I sure as fuck don't have 40 grand for that.
Well, that is ridiculous. I think you lucked out with 15.ca. That's easy to remember. Yeah. And no, it's wonderful. Well, listen, Raymond, again, thank you so much for being on the show and for joining me for this chat. I hope you enjoyed yourself. And
I did. Yeah.
I wish you the best of luck in the future, and I hope we talk soon.
Absolutely, Vish. You keep good over there, right?
Well, if you heard the previous episode of this show, episode 858 with Cadence Weapon, you would have heard me say to Rolly, you know, I've been meaning to have Raymond on this show, and I'm going to make it happen, and I must say I'm happy that it happened. I did it. I got it done. And thank you, Raymond, for appearing on this, the 859th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever most people get their podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me, please visit vishkhanna.com. You can also click on the hyperlink text that says follow Vish online to, yeah, follow me on all the various things, social media things. And there's a YouTube channel for the show, which mostly just has the audio from the podcast, but sometimes there are the odd... there's the odd video thing, and other things too. I'd say most importantly in that list of things is patreon.com/creativecontrol, where anyone can go to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast running and to provide me with a livelihood. This is my primary source of income, and I love doing the show and don't really want to be doing anything else. And so if you are able, if you're able to support the show financially, please do. There are some incentives at the different tier levels. Starting at $4 American a month, you get access to ad-free episodes, and you get episodes earlier than everybody else. At $6, you get bonus content, plus the other stuff I just said. $10, you get all that stuff I just said, plus you get entered into monthly prize pack draws at the $10 level, and so forth. And as I've been saying of late, if you are if you or someone you know is interested in making a larger monthly donation, well, you're more than welcome to. And if you're having any trouble doing that, just contact me, and I'll help you figure it out. You can contact me on the Patreon, I think. That's probably the easiest way. I appreciate the support. Thank you so much. It really does mean a lot. Speaking of which, I want to thank Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with bricks and mortar locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta. And you can learn more about them at blackbird.ca. Also to independent businesses like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. They all provide in-kind support for this show and have for many years. Also want to thank Jim Guthrie. I love Jim. He's a good friend of mine. He loans me music that I use on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Raymond. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed talking to him, and that you'll check out his stuff and this great book. I'm looking at it right now. It's on my desk, 305 Lost Buildings of Canada. And otherwise, I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast or follow it and leave nice ratings and reviews on your pod platform there. And tell your friends about the show, too. Word of mouth really helps spread the word about Creative Control. So thank you for all those things. Otherwise, just have a good time in life, and I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.